The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
In today's episode, Major Eric Chaya welcomes Major Kyle Schultz to the Trident Room podcast to discuss the thesis topic he and his partner are working on, which is the implementation of permaculture practices and how they can be used to bolster resilience within the Philippines.
Good morning, good evening, throw an afternoon in there. My name's Major Eric Chaya. I'm the host of the Trident Room podcast today. And with me, I have Major Kyle Schultz, a fellow Wisconsinite, a fellow defense analysis student, and member of U.S. Army Special Operations Command. I'd like to hand it over to you, Kyle, to just do a little introduction about your Army background up to this point.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me here. I'm a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, Madison.
You're a Badger.
Yeah, I'm a Badger. I didn't do ROTC, actually. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life for the entire duration of college, so.
You figured it out now, though?
I did, yeah. It took a while. Even when I did join the Army, I was kind of keeping my options open in the beginning. I wasn't sure, but I'm pretty comfortable where I am.
So you go to Madison, and where do you go from there?
So after I graduated, I got my bachelor's in Japanese, and then I got my master's in accounting. And so you'll see a little bit of a trend in not knowing what I want to do, right? I went to the Philippines, and I started a web-based business, gift delivery. So people that live in the U.S. or other places that know people in the Philippines and want to send them gifts, we're used to paying $30 or so for a dozen roses, or, you know, now it's probably even more than that. But I could go out and buy them for a dollar on the street and then deliver them anywhere in Metro Manila same day on my motorcycle. I just drove around and delivered them. You know, it was good, but not quite the volume of sales that I needed to survive there. So when I did end up coming back, I put in my OCS packet. I had a lot of time to think while I was there. You know, I was like, what do I actually want to do with my life since this doesn't look exactly like it's going to work out long term? So yeah, I decided I wanted to serve, trying to make the world a better place, you know?
I did ROTC, so I'm not as familiar with OCS, but give us a little OCS background.
Because I was a college option OCS, I had to go to basic training first. So I started basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina in November of 2012. And despite being from Wisconsin and having spent multiple nights outside in the wintertime, because I was a Boy Scout, so I camped outside. We did winter camping every year, all of that. I've been outside when it's been below zero, but I've never been as cold in my entire life as I was in South Carolina because I had to wear exactly the same uniform when it was 33 degrees outside as I have to wear when it's 100 degrees outside. So that was an eye-opening experience for me. After basic training, when you start OCS, actually, it's a little different than ROTC. Actually, I don't know about ROTC. You don't know what your branch is going to be when you start either, right? You find out later. So OCS, that process of finding out your branch is determined based on an OML that's set by everything that happens up to week 6 or whatever week it is. It might be week 4. They just have an OML. You put your branches that you want. They go down what's available. And just whoever's first on the OML, if their number one is available, they get it. So sometimes infantry is the first to go, and sometimes the last person in the class ends up with infantry. And I just use infantry as an example because the class before me, the last person ended up getting infantry. But in mine, it was one of the most desirable ones with the least amount of slots. So it was one of the first to actually run out of slots available. I was a signal officer, though. So I went signal, went to Fort Gordon after that. I was there for a few months. And then I went to my first duty station at Fort Bragg, which is now Fort Liberty, where I spent the rest of my career until I came here to NPS. There at Fort Liberty, I supported PSYOP, actually. So despite learning signal stuff in Bolick, I never learned anything about the AV side of the audiovisual side of signal. So 25 mics, they're graphic illustrators, 25 Romeos. It's audiovisual equipment operator maintainers. I don't even think these MOSs exist anymore, or they've transitioned recently, I heard, into PAO or something. But 46 series, like voice broadcaster MOS. Army has these MOSs, which they work with signal and PSYOP, but no training on it. So that was my lieutenant time, learning about these MOSs and what they do, and learn a lot from my NCOs. It's probably the number one thing I learned as a lieutenant is trust my NCOs.
So you do your time as a signal officer, and then you decide selections, the route to go. Talk about your time post-selection.
Then I went to Civil Affairs Assessment and Selection. was selected, went back, did all the out-processing things, and I was actually fortunate to start the CA qualification course pretty quick in my cycle. I think it was about 18 months of training until I graduated. A little background on me. I already said I got my bachelor's in Japanese, and I lived in the Philippines, and I'm actually married to a Filipina, and they taught me Korean in the schoolhouse at SWCC. So the Army decided to send me to the AFRICOM-aligned Civil Affairs Battalion. It makes perfect sense. And so I got there and I was like, okay, I'm going to hit the ground running. Let me learn as much as I can about AFRICOM. And I was there for 3 months before they decided, actually, this guy should be in Indo-PACOM. So then they moved me over to the Indo-PACOM battalion, where they sent me to Syria. So...
And we go where we're
needed. Yeah, we always go where we're needed. So that was my experience in Syria. Actually, I had a fantastic experience working with the cross-functional team. Lots of people haven't had the best experience working with cross-functional teams. They think they're kind of dysfunctional or they have frictions and things. But my experience was very positive.
Yeah, and I think General Brennan and General Marks would love hearing that. Do you want to talk just a couple seconds about your experience with the cross-functional team?
Yeah, so at the CFT that I was working with, it wasn't even just Army cross-functional team. It was like joint cross-functional team. I had naval dog handlers, Air Force JTAC, a PSYOPer, the ODA was there, of course. We had 11 Bravos from conventional forces, our infantry unit. We had an Air Force GST, the ground surgical team, even an Army EOD were there. And all of us worked in the same joint operations center every day, doing whatever we needed to do to support the overall mission. The synergies that are envisioned were materialized in this specific case, I believe. Yes, positive experiences.
We have all sorts of options in USASOC. You can go to intermediate level education in Fort Leavenworth at the Command General Staff College. You can go to the National Defense University right there at Fort Liberty. You never moved, so you decided to finally pick up and move. What made you decide to come to the Naval Postgraduate School? How'd you go about that?
I was lucky in that I grew up in PSYOP. So PSYOP also has the opportunity to come here to Naval Postgraduate School. I had a commander when I was a lieutenant who had gone here, and he was a great leader. He was very inspiring. The battalion that I was part of, we were the signal soldiers in a PSYOP unit. So we kind of had that identity difficulty of trying to always impress the people.
And
it was
been to a selection. The
people yeah, so
pretty neat.
We always had to work hard. And when I first got there, it had been kind of low. And when he first got there, it was still very low. And he was able to turn the company around just through his good leadership. But he also took us lieutenants kind of under his wing and talked about future things. And that was something I hadn't known about or thought about before. And he had gone here to NPS. So I had the exposure to this as even being an option back when I was a first lieutenant. So when I first learned about it, I was like, oh, it's in California. That's cool. I think that'd be something I might want to do someday. And then I just kind of threw it somewhere in the back of my mind and didn't think about it again until I was a captain doing my team time and getting ready to do my next move, starting to hear about, oh, ILE is a thing. And I was like, oh yeah. And I had another commander within CA that had also been here to NPS, and he was a big fan. He got a lot out of it. And so talking to both of them, and then my next unit, the last one that I was at before I came here, I also had multiple people who had been here to NPS. Not a single one had anything bad to say about it. So it was a no-brainer. When I put my packet together, I was like, okay, I really want to do this.
The company commander you had when you were a lieutenant who brought morale up, do you know where that person is? Are they still in the Army? Are they still a PSYOP officer?
Colonel Alexander was at First Group last time I ran into him. He might be retired by now.
Anyway, we'll have to send him this.
Yeah. And then Colonel Steffens, I believe he's a PMS at a university out in New York.
You're here at NPS. You know you have this looming research methods class coming up where it forces us, all us defense analysis students, to sit down and write on a piece of paper what your thesis is going to be, what the proposal looks like, who your advisor team is. Can you talk me through how you arrived at your thesis idea and what that process selecting the team was like?
Sure. When I first got here to campus, My neighbor actually walked across the street because he saw I had a Green Bay Packer bumper sticker on my car, and he was from Wisconsin. And
I remember this.
Yeah. So, no, Eric, talking to you about your thesis actually is really what inspired me to do something outside the norm. So, you know, your thesis with regenerative agriculture and adaptive multi-paddock grazing really kind of gave me the idea like, okay, well, I like that a lot, actually. This thing seems like it's beneficial in a non-traditional way, but very beneficial to us. And maybe I can find something that probably isn't going to be quite as beneficial, but still can be beneficial to the environment, the world, that can help poverty and some of the issues in the Philippines while also achieving DOD objectives. And so what we're looking at is the implementation of sustainable agricultural practices. And I chose sustainable agriculture instead of regenerative agriculture just because it's a broader category. The way I see it, regenerative is a specific term within the broader category of sustainable agricultural practices. And I don't mean sustainable as in like limiting us to just what we have right now. I mean it as what's sustainable long term for the future. So it actually includes regenerating the soil.
Yeah, and we'll get into this too, I'm sure, but we had a conversation before we started talking today about words matter and context specifically in the Philippines. So I know we're going to talk about that, so I don't want to jump into that yet, but can you talk about how you and Louis teamed up and decided this is what we're going to write about for the next year?
Initially, it was how can regenerative agriculture be used to build resilience and resistance in the Philippines? And we chose the Philippines because of its proximity to China, its importance as a U.S. partner internationally, and both of us understand and have connections to the Philippines.
You both have a unique context, that's for sure. Like, you understand the context. You've spent time there. You've married someone from there. Louis, can you talk a little bit about Louis? I know he's not here, but...
Louis is a Filipino-American, lived there for a while when he was younger, and now he's here as also an Army officer. He's another civil affairs officer here. He did most of his time in the Indo-PACOM Aligned Battalion, and he's been to the Philippines operationally for exercises and things.
You guys have relationships established already. Yes. So you're leveraging that in your thesis work.
Trying to. Yeah. We're working on it. We actually just got back from the Philippines this weekend. We met with a few different people there, and we got some interesting perspectives. So the sustainable agricultural thing that we're going to focus on in our thesis in the Philippines, they call it permaculture. It initially was permanent agriculture, but now it's kind of become permanent culture because they believe in a whole kind of cultural communal way of looking at the systems that they talk about designing. But we got a bunch of different perspectives. The first meeting that we had, it was with the professor, Dr. Jabez Flores, and the Dean Serrano of the Faculty of Management and Development Studies at the University of the Philippines Open University. And Dr. Flores has published a lot about permaculture. He's looked at it through a bunch of different lenses, from systems analysis to social network analysis. And
so he's not looking at it from a linear kind of reductionist model. This has been like that. I like that you said system sciences. I know you're interested in system sciences. How does permaculture in the Philippines strengthen resilience and resistance?
Essentially through the development of food security, bolstering local economies, and developing or helping develop self-sufficiency and community networks. So what this Open University, the UPOU, has right now, they have their Perma Garden, which is a community garden that anybody is allowed to go and access at any time. And they're managing it in accordance with permaculture practices. And they even went as far as to create kind of a community currency of favors. So when somebody does a favor for one person, they can give them, basically it's like a certificate or something, is my way of understanding. They're able to use this currency and actually track it so they can see who is talking to who and the connections between the person who's planting it and the person who's bringing the soil or whatever processes are happening throughout the whole cultural system, broader than just the garden itself.
Right. It's like making the relationship from the conception to consumption tangible. It's a piece of paper that says how this has formed. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. I think they just started it, so they're working on the actual logistics of it, but that's kind of the idea as I understood it, and it seemed really interesting, and I'm in contact with them to talk more about things as we move forward in our thesis. Another perspective that we got was the Philippine Permaculture Association. They have an eco house in Marikina City, which is part of Metro Manila. It's a downtown. There's huge skyscrapers within close distance of this location. He's got trees that shade the property, and it's naturally cool. Walking through the gate, it felt like it was 5 degrees cooler than just off the property. And then we're talking just a few, I don't even know how many square meters, maybe 100, 200 square meters at the most. All made of natural materials. They capture their own rainwater. They use composting toilets. They do all this stuff to not rely on the grid. And so by doing that, they're maintaining their independent resiliency of their facility, just that location, but at a bigger scale. It can help them in natural disasters. It helps them mitigate any kind of environmental impact that they could be having. It reduces the reliance on external imports to address some of their issues. So we're looking at how the U.S. can get the most bang for its buck in encouraging this as a way to negate the need for longer term commitments.
I hear a lot of that, what you're saying. The one food security conversation that I hear, because our thesis are very similar, and you know, we get asked, how are you going to feed the world when you're not utilizing industrialized agriculture methods? And I think where permaculture really emphasizes, this 1 acre is not just producing one thing. This 1 acre produces fruit, nuts, protein, whatever it does throughout the year, multiple harvests of different types of produce, of pasture, of whatever it is. Have you gotten any pushback when you've been talking about your thesis? Hey, how do you do this at scale? You know, how does the U.S. even advocate for something like this in the Philippines?
The biggest challenge within the Philippines, according to every party we met with, is getting people to change their mindset. And it's very similar to the challenge that I'm sure you face with regenerative agriculture, or that the whole regenerative movement faces, regarding how quickly you can get results by just putting down fertilizer. You're going to see the results a lot faster than if you have to do the practices that take a long time for the soil to actually just get healthier so that you end up with a better result in the end. In the Philippines, another issue that they're facing, 73% of their food is imported, despite having an incredible amount of arable land. That's an issue potentially. Anything we can do to encourage their own local production, and if we can do it even more sustainably, then that's going to benefit.
In a broad sense, why does permaculture matter to the United States Department of Defense?
The National Defense Strategy outlines a world that's characterized by strategic competition, with the People's Republic of China presenting the most significant challenge to U.S. national security. It involves a larger whole-of-society approach that's going to do this. Comprehensive defense from the NATO Comprehensive Defense Handbook. Resiliency is one of the foundations of comprehensive defense. Food security is a critical component of resiliency. If one hurricane, you know, a natural disaster can come in and wipe out your food. Or we had the opportunity also to go to Batanes earlier this year, which is a province in the Philippines, with the Energy Academic Group. We did a tabletop exercise up there. And for a large portion of the year, ships can't get in and out of the island because the port is too small to accommodate shipping. So they're limited to like one aircraft a day when it's able to do it. And they just have to be resilient. They've got their own systems. They have one power generation facility. If it goes down, or any of the distribution lines go down anywhere, then it can create a huge problem. So the people individually need to be resilient. The U.S. cares because the Philippines is an important partner, and resilience can help increase the resistance capacity of the Philippines, should it be needed. DOD cares.
We are close to our time limit here. Is there anything else, any advice, any nuances that you've come across that maybe other students could benefit from, or maybe some acknowledgement?
Of course, my family has listened to me talk about this for a while, and just like to thank them for tolerating it, and you for planting the seed of doing something out of the box that can still have a big impact. Dr. Bohr, Dr. Hauk both started out initially. Dr. Hauk's not a formal advisor anymore, but she was still very supportive initially of getting it going. And Dr. Bohr, he's our current thesis advisor. He's pushing it through. Kristen Fletcher, same. We've got support. Dr. Greenshields funded our trip to the Philippines. thankfully.
And I just don't see if we went a different route for ILE, for intermediate level education. I mean, how many times have you been to the Philippines? How many tabletop exercises? This stuff doesn't happen when you're just in and out of something really quick. You've had time to utilize your past experience, but also like saturate yourself in your current studies thanks to this platform.
Yes. NPS is unique in that the duration of time that we're here really can allow us to focus on something that we want to focus on. And it can be something unusual. And I think
it's the time and it's just the atmosphere here.
Yeah, the supportive faculty that didn't try to be like, to you, what are you talking about, cows? Like, get out of here. The fact that they're supportive of it, and you kind of paved the way for me to do something just related to agriculture. So I didn't have the same hurdles I'm sure you had to overcome. It was a little bit less of a challenge, but definitely thankful for everybody supporting the crazy idea of sustainable agriculture in the Philippines.
Kyle, thank you for being here. Thanks for your time. And this closes out another episode of the Trident Room podcast.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at tridentroompodcasthost@nps.edu.